Welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm your host, John Tanza, on this live broadcast from Washington. Here are some of the top stories making news across Sudan and South Sudan this Monday, April 8, 2024. Residents of Juba Town complain about the high rate of crime in the city.
We put our forces, we alerted them in regard to this to follow up such cases. Sometimes you get people claim to be using their know-how as a public transport, but sometimes they victimize some of our people.
And the French medical charity, MSF, says Sudan's humanitarian crisis has been neglected.
Is a high level of neglect. This conflict, which has already claimed many lives and displaced millions of people inside Sudan and in the region, has not received the attention it deserves.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Some residents of South Sudan's capital, Juba, are complaining about robberies by criminals who use private vehicles pretending to offer rides to commuters. Some residents who were robbed say the police are doing very little to apprehend the robbers. Viola Elias has more for VOA from Juba.
Seba Martin, a resident of Juba's Gudere neighborhood, was robbed by criminals posing to be taxi drivers or good Samaritans along the streets of Juba. Seba says she was picked up in the Munuki residential area by a group of three young men who offered her a ride along Gudele Road.
So I got into the white, nice-looking car. The guys inside were well-dressed in some white shirt and black trousers, looking like bank guys. They were really smart. So we drove off, and then reaching somewhere around the junction of St. Kizito, they were like, they are sorry, they have a change of plan. Meanwhile, I had put my bag just next to me in the car, and the other guy was also just next to me there. And when I came out of the car, I found out that I had notes of 500, like 25,000, and then I had a note of 1,000, like about 15,000. All this money was not there.
Caroline Kiden, another Gudele resident, says she was picked up early one morning. She says after a short distance, the driver said he would no longer drive to Juba Town bus park and stopped at Airport Junction.
I wanted to open the door. It was stuck and couldn't open. I wanted to put my hands outside to open it from outside, and the outer hand was broken and couldn't open. I didn't know the guy from behind was holding the door, not open. In that process, I was struggling to open the door. The guy next to me opened my bag, removed my wallet with $600 and threw it down near the driver. Luckily, when they finally left the door open for me to get down, I saw my wallet near the driver.
Emmanuel Paul, a resident who lives in Kator area, says he thinks the crime has increased in recent days in Juba. He says criminals driving minibuses known as Noha are armed and often threaten to kill people tricked by offers of free ride.
Here in Kator, we had experienced a serious theft. A white Noah came and it looked like a car that had been driven out of the garage. We have kids here who usually sit at the riverbank, so the Noah guys stopped and threatened the kids with a gun that if anyone said anything, he or she would be shot.
South Sudan Police spokesperson Major General Daniel Justin says the police have not received reports of armed robberies around Juba. Justin says he only saw some discussions of criminal activities on social media.
The issue of these know-hows, sometimes back we got the information and we put our forces, we alerted them in regard to this to follow up such cases. Sometimes you get people claim to be using their know-hows as a public transport, but sometimes they victimize some of our people. But the issue we were facing was that, you see, all this we are getting it from social media. We have never registered a single case in a police station that somebody gave himself a chance of going to the police station, saying that I was going from A to Z. On the way, ABC happens to me.
Justin urges people to alert the police or call the emergency lines when they see criminal activity.
To pass appeal to the public that whenever there is a suspected situation or any insecurity you feel in an area, you just either call the emergency call number or you approach the nearest police station, especially or on the street. We have our night patrol forces. And then we have our checkpoints on the streets. So if you report, even if you don't feel that you are very far, you cannot make it, but we have people on the ground. When the guy, we got the information, locate your place, we can reach you in a very short time.
Earlier this year, South Sudan Police Service installed CCTV cameras across the city to detect and track criminals. When the cameras began operating in January, Angelina Teng, the Minister of Interior, warned would-be criminals that their activities would be closely monitored. For VOA News, I am Viola Elias reporting from Juba.
From Juba, we move to Yei, where some South Sudanese in Yei River County say they are unable to withdraw money from their MTN mobile money accounts, known as Momo. And they blame the telecommunications network for months now. The people in Yei say they have resorted to other alternatives to receive money rather than relying on the mobile money service. For VOA News, Dennis Longonyi reports from Juba.
Irima Rashid, a welder in Yei town, says problems with MTN mobile money service have slowed down his business, and he is not able to use the cash he receives in a timely manner because of the depreciation of the South Sudanese pound. Rashid is calling on the telecom network to look into the matter so users can withdraw money on time without restrictions.
This issue of Momo in Yei here is now a problem. If they send you some money and you go to any MTN mobile money office, you won't receive your money on the same day. If the money is much like SSP 100 or 200,000, you will not be able to receive. You will go to a different agent and get small. Sometimes you may move the whole day, 2, 3, 4, or 5 days, no money. If it is something for business sent to you today, you have to receive immediately and use the money. If you don't receive immediately, you will go to the shop and find different prices.
Boboya Francis Wani, a student in Yei, says getting his money at an MTN outlet is tedious and time-consuming. He says he has to go to different mobile money agents to receive an amount of 100,000 SSP.
If you have an emergency, you find that your emergency issue will not be responded to. You can deposit your money, it's okay, there's no problem. They are welcoming. But now when it comes now to withdrawal, that is where we are facing a lot of challenges. Sometimes they are saying there's no money. They are saying unless maybe if it is 50,000 below, like maybe I want to withdraw like maybe 200. You won't get that money. If I want to maybe do some photocopying or some activities in the school, and if that money is not there, it's useless for me to open a Momo account.
MTN is one of the largest mobile telecommunication companies in South Sudan. Its mobile money service allows customers to send and receive money in the form of cash or airtime. MTN FinTech Service Limited handles the mobile money operation in South Sudan. Agnes Arie is an MTN Momo agent. She says at first the service was fine, then limits were set on the amount of money sent to super users or dealers, a process called a float. After that, users in Juba, Morobo and Yei began to have problems accessing their money.
For almost 1 month, we have been experiencing challenges. Customers can come, they want to withdraw money, but there's no cash, and it has gotten us so worried. Yet customers are our number one priorities. So I think one of the reasons why there's no cash is we have more withdrawals than deposits. Most people in Juba and other places send people in Yei, yet we have less deposit.
An agent only identified as James for fear of losing his business says the only super dealer for Yei, Morobo and Kaya has gotten less money from MTN. Calls on MTN to increase the number of dealers so that they can better serve the area.
We have a little capital and this makes it a bit hard to sustain the customers when they come. By around 11, you find that cash is no longer there. The whole day, you keep sending the customers away. They go from one agent to another. They keep loitering the whole day. It's a big challenge indeed. We believe that if the commission is a bit fairer, we could get what is accumulated in our commission pot to increase our working capital to serve as many customers as possible.
Chan Andrea, the Director General for Bank Supervision at the Central Bank of South Sudan, says the central bank regulates mobile money operations in the country.
Fintechs and mobile money companies are not allowed to compete with the banks, and therefore there are some requirements when it comes to the limits of transaction that you can do per day. This limit is not cast in stone. It's something that can be revised from time to time. So we normally have engagements with the mobile money companies whenever we see that the limit, the market is picking up and the limit is not commensurate with the activities in the markets, then we come and revise those limits.
VOA called and emailed MTN several times to get a comment. Dennis Lejubo, an MTN communications officer, responded that the company officials in charge of mobile money are not in the country and he cannot comment. For VOA News, I'm Dennis Logonyi reporting from Juba.
From Juba, we move to Nairobi, where the French medical charity MSF says Sudan is one of the worst crises in the world has seen for decades. The group says there are extreme levels of suffering across the country, adding that the needs are growing day by day, but the humanitarian response is deeply inadequate. MSF's operation manager, Abdallah Hussein, says the international community should not forget the humanitarian crisis in Sudan.
MSF has been trying to assist the population in Sudan for the last 1 year. We operate at the moment in different regions, including Darfur, Khartoum, Jazeera State, which are the most affected states in terms of the armed conflict. We are trying to do our best to scale up our assistance at the moment, but there is a massive gap of aid in the country. The needs are huge that our teams are overstretched. In the month of January, we did an assessment of malnutrition in the camp of Zamzam that's located close to the El Fashir town in North Darfur. We found an alarming state of malnutrition in the children under five. And today, the MSF is trying to set up a hospital to care for the malnourished children. But we are calling for more aid to be delivered in Sudan, and not only in North Darfur, but in different regions, because we are observing the same situation everywhere.
And your statement was saying whatever has been delivered is a drop of water in the ocean. Tell us how difficult it is to reach those who are really affected by this conflict.
Well, there are difficulties in terms of access across Sudan. We have difficulties, for example, to ship supplies to our hospitals. We have also difficulties with visas of personnel to get the permits and the visas that international health workers and humanitarian personnel need to support the Sudanese colleagues who are already on the ground. So that's one major constraint, and it's one that we are requesting for the warring parties and authorities in Sudan, especially in Port Sudan, to facilitate and put in place a system, a permit system that's more simplified and facilitates humanitarian aid. The other challenge, of course, is the assistance, which is not adequate, and we are overstretched, and in most of the places we feel very long alone. For example, in North Darfur that I was speaking about, there is most of the organizations left in April 2023, and since then they did not come back. And we have three health facilities there, and at the moment, those three health facilities that are supported by MSF are the only ones serving a population of 2.8 million, which is really an enormous task And that's why we are calling for a scale-up of humanitarian assistance and protection.
Let's talk about donors' response. I know that there is conflict in Ukraine, there is conflict in Gaza, and the Sudan's conflict seemed to have gained little attention. How is the donor response?
Well, we have the same feeling. I confirm that there is a high level of neglect with this conflict, which has already claimed many lives and displaced millions of people inside Sudan and in the region, has not received the attention it deserves. There are the places where we are present, and where MSF is present. We see what some of my colleagues refer to as humanitarian desert. So we don't have a humanitarian actors that we normally see in a crisis of this nature on the ground. And of course, the terms of the funding. I know that the refugees, the Sudanese refugees in Chad, on the Chad border in east of Chad, are also struggling in terms of the organization don't have funding. So the aid is also being scaled down there.
How would you see Sudan moving on from now with all these challenges that you are mentioning? I mean, it appears like there's no light at the end of the tunnel. How do you see Sudan moving forward?
Well, I really hope that we will not have another year of neglect, of obstruction to humanitarian assistance, of violating the civilian population, of breaking the of international humanitarian law. And so I that's what we are hoping for. That's what we are calling for. For MSF, as much as possible, we're trying to reach the population, but we cannot do it alone, and we are calling for donors, for international community, for international organizations to do more to get aid across the borders of Sudan and also to facilitate within Sudan.
That's Abdallah Hussein, MSF's Operation Manager for East Africa. He spoke to me today from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, the people of Rwanda commemorate 100 years of genocide. That story is coming to you after this break.
Hello, listener of South Sudan in Focus. We have an exciting new segment dubbed Words of Wisdom. We want to hear your thoughtful proverbs that echo through your community. This is another chance for you to share wisdom from your roots. All you need to do is record a proverb in a language of your choice, tell us its English translation and what it means. Keep it brief, authentic, and represent your community. Your recorded proverb shall be sampled on South Sudan in Focus every Wednesday. Send your recording via our WhatsApp number, +1 202 630 8011. That is +1 202 630 8011.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. I would like to make that correction. The people of Rwanda are commemorating 30 years after the country witnessed the worst genocide in history. 30 years after the Rwandan genocide, survivors continue to grapple with fear and trauma. Their plight, they say, is exacerbated by ongoing battles against misinformation and genocide denial, prompting calls for increased education and awareness to foster genocide-free world. President Salva Kiir traveled to the Rwandan capital, Kigali, to join President Paul Kagame in this commemoration. Sinau Todd reports from Kigali, Rwanda.
Patrick Sidikubwabo was only 4 years old when his father and three siblings were killed during the 1994 Rwandan genocide. 30 years on, he says the memory still haunts him and is part of his story he can never forget. Another survivor, Jean-Claude Mugabe, was 9 when his father and uncles had to flee their house, leaving women and children behind. He says his relatives sought refuge in the village church, but were found and many of them killed.
I lost many siblings, you know, close relatives, such as aunt, uncles, cousins, you know. If I count it very well, they reach to 65 people. My uncle, the brother of my mom, he died with her wife and his whole children. So the family finished.
Mugabe later found his little sister and father had been murdered.
I participate, you know, in burying his remain. The only thing I could remember is his jackets, you know. Others will remain.
During a 100-day period in 1994, Rwanda's Hutu majority killed more than 800,000 minority Tutsis and Hutu moderates. The genocide in Rwanda was sparked by hate speech, mostly over the radio, by Hutu extremists against Tutsis. Mugabe says many survivors were traumatized, grieved, and radicalized. And at his age, he did not understand why his father had to be killed.
And sometimes I can say, if I can see the killer of my father, so I will do that. I will revenge as well.
The Aegis Trust, a non-profit dedicated to genocide prevention, has been running genocide memorial centers across the country with the goal of helping people heal and learn about genocide prevention. Freddie Matangua from Aegis Trust explains.
We do it through peace education program by understanding the past, but also building up the skills and the values that helps people to be able to develop critical thinking, the empathy, personal responsibility.
Mugabe has been part of the program and says it's helped him heal. He has even met with some of his father's killers and forgiven them.
I understood better and more when I walked the memorial, and I started also supporting others from my community and my colleagues who have not yet moved forward.
UNESCO cites a lack of education as one of the causes of genocide, saying people turned against each other through misinformation. They have moved to recognize four memorial sites in Rwanda as World Heritage Sites. Audrey Azule is UNESCO's Director General.
The sites have to be preserved because what happened here matters for all humanity. It's a stain on the universal conscience, and we have to preserve the sites so first as to fight against distortion or denial of history.
Rwanda is marking the anniversary of the genocide against Tutsis with 100 days of remembrance. During this period, survivors are calling for more education and awareness to help combat genocide denial and misinformation, part of their healing journey. Sena Nutod, VOA News, Kigali, Rwanda.
On his farm near Burkina Faso's capital, Ouagadougou, Clark Logren studies and breeds wild animals, some of them endangered species. The Canadian, who has been living in the country for several decades, is also giving tourists an opportunity to see his animals up close. But fighting and unrest in the country has put the farm at risk. VOA's Gildas Dar has more in this report, narrated by Jackson Vunganyi.
It's feeding time for Clark Longren's warthogs. This is just one of the species the Canadian-born wild animal breeder is raising on his 70 hectares in Wedbila, a village near Burkina Faso's capital, Ouagadougou. Another is the potter pig, a cross between a Red River hog and a pig. Langren says a male from this species was mated with a domestic pig. She gave birth to a mixed offspring, and someone from Abome Kalavi University discovered and preserved them.
A male from this species mated with a domestic pig. She gave birth to mixed offspring, and someone from Kalavi University discovered and preserved them.
But not all animals can breed. This female hyena is waiting for a mate, something Longren hopes to provide soon. The Wedbila demonstration farm was established in 1998 with the goal of providing breeding animals for farms and contributing to environmental education. Longren also hopes to reintroduce species that have disappeared from Burkina Faso, like the critically endangered red-necked ostrich, also called the North African ostrich. He says the red-necked ostriches are the strain of wild ostriches of Burkina Faso. They disappeared about 50 years ago. He wants to breed them, collaborating with others in Benin, Niger, and more.
les autruches, qui est la souche sauvage.
Red-necked ostriches are the strain of wild ostriches of Burkina Faso. They disappeared about 50 years ago. We want to breed them, collaborating with others in Benin, Niger, and more.
On collabore avec d'autres personnes au Burkina aussi qui font ça.
It takes about 45 minutes to complete a tour of the farm. Visitors can admire pythons, jackals, a martial eagle, and a waterbuck standing over 1.75 meters tall. They may catch a glimpse of the horse-like hartbeest.
That's all we prepared for you this Monday, April 8, 2024, when I leave you with Victoria Ole and Kasang Dedi with the song Salamia Sudan. We've been listening to Victoria Ole and Kasang Dedi with the song Salam. Yeah, Sudan, indeed. Sudan needs peace. I'm your host, John Tanza, on this live broadcast from Studio 14 here in Washington. On behalf of our producer, Kwame Ofori, and engineer, Alfredo Santos, we wish you a lovely evening. Remember to join us again tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. بالدم وحياة فلنسجد حقوق بيتهم أولاد بيتهم في وقت السلام تعالوا يا ناس نمسك الوحدة يدينا سوا نبني السودان دارين حكومة وغنون
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Assistant Secretary of State for Population, Refugees, and Migration, Julieta Valls-Noyes, recently traveled to Ethiopia and Chad, where she met with senior government officials, humanitarian leaders, and refugees to discuss the growing humanitarian and migration crises in both Central and Eastern Africa. During her meeting with Chad's Prime Minister, Sukse Masra, Assistant Secretary Noyes announced more than $47 million in humanitarian assistance for Sudan and neighboring countries.
That amount of money brings the total U.S. humanitarian assistance for people in Sudan and neighboring countries to more than $968 million since last fiscal year. The United States is the leading humanitarian donor to the Sudan emergency response. We are committed to working with other members of the international community to help alleviate the suffering of over 1 million refugees forced to flee their homes due to violence, with more arriving daily, as I saw during my visit.
Both Ethiopia and Chad are playing essential roles in the Sudan response and broader humanitarian efforts, said Assistant Secretary Noyes.
Since early 2023, Ethiopia has welcomed nearly 50,000 refugees from Sudan. At a time of great instability in the Horn of Africa, Ethiopia's support for displaced populations remains absolutely critical. The government of Ethiopia has worked closely with humanitarian actors to establish new refugee sites and provide essential life-saving aid to the tens of thousands of new refugee arrivals.
Assistant Secretary Noyes expressed the United States' deep appreciation for the generosity of the people of the government of Chad throughout their long history as a refugee host country.
Most recently, Chad has embraced the immense challenge of welcoming over 500,000 refugees and over 100,000 returnees in less than a year. We remain steadfastly committed to supporting vulnerable people in Chad, in particular the over 1.1 million refugees and asylum seekers. U.S.-supported programs will support protection, shelter, water and sanitation, education, and more for refugees, host communities, and others affected by the crisis in Sudan.
Preventing famine and long-term catastrophe in Sudan will require both a ceasefire and unhindered humanitarian access, stressed Assistant Secretary Noyes. We in the United States are committed to work with the governments of Ethiopia and Chad and with international and local partners to provide life-saving support to the millions of people affected by the devastating conflict in Sudan.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.